Welcome to Oldie Radio. I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and today I'm very excited to be in the home of one of our most treasured actors, John Standing. He might not have won an Oscar yet for a starring role as a romantic lead, but he is without question an instantly recognisable face on stage, screen and television, having been at it for a very, very long time. You'll forgive me for saying that he's now 90. And last year he starred with Michael Caine and Glenda Jackson in the runaway hit The Great Escaper. John, it's an absolute joy to be talking to you. Good morning.
Morning.
Let's start with The Great Escaper, because you are all getting on a little bit. Glenda Jackson, sadly, of course, no longer with us, having died last year at 87. But Michael Caine is a year older than you. Now, for any older reader who has not seen this film, it's an absolute must. Tell our listeners what the premise of it is.
Good God. I mean, listen, I'm an actor. I'm an idiot, like, you know, all my trade. The premise is it that the old man who ran away from his home, and it was a care home. He ran away from his care home, and his wife, who was Glenda Jackson, and went to see the D-Day landings because he felt riddled with guilt about something that had happened during the war. And on his way across on the ferry, he meets this man who wants to help him. And it's a combination of what happens to these two men who are very unlikely travellers, and something astonishingly happened to both of them. And they both have to see and reconcile it and then return, really, one way or another. But it was an incredibly good script, but really inventive.
Written by James Ivory.
Absolutely, indeed, yeah. Written by James Ivory, who's a really distinguished and brilliant writer. So it was nothing but a joy to do. Poor Michael was in a terrible state because he'd battered his back, and he bravely went on holding onto a board all the way through, and gives a spectacular performance. He's wonderful in it, I think, really wonderful.
You're all absolutely wonderful.
And so is Glenda. She's brilliant in it, quite extraordinary. And very sadly died immediately it was over. So, you know, I had to do sort of chats and things with Michael, a most incongruous and unlikely couple. But there as we go. We've been banging on together, and he is an adorable man. So there we are. That's the premise of it, rather badly. I wasn't expecting it as a question. But there we are. I expect there'll be quite a few questions that I won't know the answer to, and I'll be the first to say so, as I was heaved out of every single school that had almost ever existed, certainly in my lifetime. So anyway, yes, what? Charlotte, darling.
So let's talk about your background. Why were you thrown out of so many schools then?
Oh, well, because I was lazy, naughty, and only wanted to make people laugh, which was obviously incredibly unpopular. Because people who were serious about their work, and I ought to have been, and was absolutely crazy not to have been. My prep school, I managed to survive, God knows how, I think by playing endless cricket, and I was a first 11 colour for a couple of years, which was, to me, meant more than anything else. But I kept on being hit by my headmaster. In those days, they thought that hitting children was the way to make them better or more attentive or whatever in class, which of course was appalling. So I was struck, and my headmaster was a clergyman. He was a canon, no less, and used to take me into his horrible smelly bedroom at night, pull down my pyjama trousers and smack me with his slipper. And it was a ritual that seemed to happen an awful lot. And then I went to my public school, and when I arrived, there was a list of things that we had to do. And then on the top of the list said, gentlemen will do so-and-so. Gentlemen will be a report to take. And I said, gentlemen, I'm 13, for Christ's sakes. How anybody could call me a gentleman? And I was a tiny little kind of very young-looking, rather small 13-year-old. Who's up to all forms of devilment you could ever imagine. And finally, I was what was called swiped twice. It was a school disgrace to be swiped, period, at all.
What did swiping mean?
It meant flogging. I was flogged twice, which meant a birch. on a bare bottom. And your the ritual was unbelievable. And it was the steps inevitably were 400 years old, which you were sort of held captive to by what some man called the school messenger, who was a big burly fellow who was indeed a school messenger. They held your head between his knees, and you bared your bottom to, in my case, the lower master. And I was swiped, which that's it.
Let me get this straight. So two large men were responsible for inflicting this beating.
No, there was one called a preposter, who was a member of the 400, the top 400, the top 100 boys in the school, who had to hold his arm out. I mean, it was completely crazy. It's actually quite comic. And the birch didn't hurt that much. It just drew blood round the front when the whip end of the birch came round and hit you in the wherever your groin. But it didn't matter, except the disgrace was monumental. And then I was superannuated, which meant I had to leave because my work didn't reach the required standard, which I suspect was negligible at the time anyway. When I left, I went to what was then a kind of bucket shop in Somerset called Millfield, which has turned into this very elaborate sports school now.
The former was Eton.
The first one was Eton, yeah. Anyway, and then when I went into the army, expecting, knowing that in my regiment were a lot of people I'd been at school with, who were absent, I thought I was such a disgrace at school, I would be kind of, chiite and put into a corner when I was a soldier. On the contrary, they could not, any of them, have been more charming and delightful and fun to be with and understanding and expecting, were more interesting if you were thrown out than if you weren't, if you managed to last the whole course. Anyway, so I have, friends from every sort of background, flavour and whatever it is now. I have no sort of class ambitions of any description, to be honest with you, nothing like that. It seems to me to be completely pointless. It's the one most ridiculous thing about our country. Anyway, there we are. That's about the long and the short of it.
So you did that. You did that was national service, which you did mostly in Germany. Is that right?
I did quite a lot of it in Germany. I did quite a lot of it in England, to begin with. I was a rifleman at Winchester with all the lads, and all the lads were basically from Canning Town and around the East End of London, and they were more fun than you could begin to imagine.
And then, so what took you to the Byamshaw School?
Oh, well, when I finished the army and I finally got a commission in a terrific regiment called the King's Royal Rifle Corps, which is now called the 60th Rifles, I was in, and they were all lovely, lovely people, top and bottom, all of them. And I became great friends with Dwyn Bramall, who became head of the whole army, the navy, the air force, and anybody who took up arms, really. And then when I left, and all I wanted to do was to draw and paint. The last thing I wanted was to be an actor, and I didn't act at school or give it a second's thought because I was surrounded by it. My grandfather was an actor, and he was in Hollywood. So he'd left and gone to Hollywood, and my mother never spoke to him again. My mother was an actress. My grandmother was an actress. My sister was an actress. And I thought, absolutely not. It's the last thing on earth I want to be. So I want to be a painter. So I got into an art school by showing them some drawings I'd done in hospital when I was in the army. And I got into art school, which was wonderful, called the Byamshaw. And I was there at exactly the same time as Hockney was at art school, the other side of London, being the genius that he is. Then my mother said, "That's enough, you've got to go to work." And I said, "But I am at work, I'm studying. I'd only been here for a year and about a month, that's all." And I'd learned, and we drew and drew and drew and drew. We weren't allowed to paint until we'd been drawing for a solid year. And then after a year, then I left, and my mother said, "You've got to go to work and earn a living." And I thought, but I'm far too stupid to be a stockbroker or anything like that, because my father was a stockbroker. And he, poor old darling, was a drunken stockbroker. When they got divorced, my mother made us wards of court, so we weren't allowed to see my father other than once every school holidays for lunch only, and once during a school term for lunch only until we were 21. That would apply to my brother and myself. And my brother was absolutely, I mean, in apoplectic with rage about it, and never really forgave my mother. But I suppose God knows why she did it, but she did. We had a stepfather who was inevitably an actor. So everything, the whole bloody lot, were prancing around on the stage. And occasionally my grandfather used to be in films like Lives of a Bengal Lancer, in which he played a woofy colonel. And he was a very sweet man, apparently. Niven told me that he was terribly kind to Niven when he was a young man, and worked with him. And then my grandfather came to England during the 1914 war, fought in the Navy, and then was knighted for spying. Nobody tells us what he did or why he was knighted, because to be a spy and a knight at the same time must have meant he'd either done something wonderful or utterly frightful. So anyway, he was Sir Guy Standing, and he went trancing back to Hollywood, got bitten by a black widow spider, which killed him.
No.
Yes, he was bitten in the wrist, apparently.
Well, let's get back to that, because so you were at the, your mother had said, get out to work.
Yes, go on.
So what did you go and do?
Well, I went and learnt a piece of Shakespeare, which involved, as a servant who rushed on with a message, crashed down on his knees and tried to remember his lines then, what he had to say as the messenger. I went and I had the arrogance of going to Stratford. So I went to Stratford, the Memorial Theatre at Stratford, as it was then, before it became the RSC, it was the Memorial Theatre. And I crashed down on my knees and got a job as a spear carrier in Titus Andronicus, which starred Laurence Olivier and indeed Vivian Leigh and Anthony Quayle, which was going on a tour to Paris, Venice, Vienna, Belgrade, Zagreb, Warsaw, London. Job one, carrying this ridiculous spear, with Peter Brook directing it, who was brilliant, absolutely astonishing. And I remember him giving the Olivier's a frightful bollocking when we were in Venice, and I thought, you cannot speak. He was aged, I don't know, 29 or something, and Larry was about to be 50. So anyway, the long and the short of it was but he gave them a terrible bollocking, and I don't know that it produced anything better than they were, because Olivier was magical in on the stage, which sadly, if one had never seen him on the stage, was a very, very, very different kettle of fish from what one sees now. Yes. On the screen. He was a stage actor, which actually, truthfully, I've been really virtually all my life. I've sashayed into doing the odd television but basically the theatre, and I really was ambitious to play, you know, really good and funny parts in the theatre, which I can't complain for a world about anything, to be honest with you. I've been phenomenally lucky and played some of the great comedies ever written. I did The Importance of Being Earnest at the Haymarket for 9 months, and then Ring Round the Moon by Henri, and then Chekhov, of course. I played Three Sisters with Judi Dench playing Irena, and I played Tusenbach in Three Sisters. Listen, I don't want to go on rolling off and showing off about what I've been, just plain lucky.
Can we talk about Maggie Smith a little bit? Because yeah, sadly, as we record this podcast, we've just lost her. Because you were with her for a long time in Noel Coward's...
In Private Lives.
Private Lives, yes.
Yeah. I'd always had anchoring. I was asked the first time I went to Los Angeles, and I came back via New York, and I was at some sort of theatre party in New York, and I was asked by a very well-known and sweet actress what you'd like to do, and I said, do you know something? The only thing I'd like to do in New York is, if I ever got a chance, I'd like to do Private Lives, God knows where or when or who with or anything. Anyway, the long and the short of it was, I was in a play of John Osborne's at the Royal Court, and Gielgud had been, I think he'd seen several things that I'd done over the years, and he said, Robert Stevens was originally in it, and for the first month, I think, they were in it together. Mm-hmm. But after 3 weeks, they were fighting and having such a terrible time, Maggie and Bob Stevens were, and that he decided to leave. And Gielgud said, would I take over? And I said, well, yeah, I'd love to. But the fact of the matter is, how long have I got? 10 days, he said, you can do it in 10 days.
What, learn the lines?
Learn the lines.
And God, what was that like?
Well, that was a fearsome struggle, to say the least. But as I'd wanted to do it more than anything, I just spent day and night, you know, learning it and fighting it in. And to begin with, it was a bit of a solemn affair, but after the next 6 months, and working with Maggie was an absolute joy. I didn't fight with her, far from it. No, it was nothing but the most wonderful thing to be in, to be perfectly honest with you. And in my estimation, it was Coward's best play, most interesting and sexy and all sorts of things, and it was wonderful and great fun to do. We went all over America doing it, from unlikely places like Denver in Colorado and LA, Denver, Boston, Toronto, and finally a season on Broadway.
What did they make of your accents in places like Denver, Colorado?
Hopefully they had, to God knows. I hope they understood. I mean, I really do. But American audiences were incredibly generous, and it had always been a joy to work there. And I'd done it before on a film with Cary Grant, that was a thing called Walk Don't Run, and we did shot that for a month in Tokyo, and then another 2 months in LA, in the studios in LA.
Who would you say the funniest person is you've worked with? Because you're very funny.
I don't. God Almighty, who's the funny? But Derek Royle. Derek Royle was an actor I was in Rep with, and Derek Royle was just breathtaking. He was a clown, and I was in Rep in Birmingham, and I was in Doctor in Love or Doctor in something or other. And anyway, and Derek used to make me laugh so much. When I was on the stage with him, not supposed to laugh at all, and I could hardly speak because he was so funny. So it was Derek Royle.
And what's
Derek
happened Royle, to him?
I don't know. I think he was laughingly known as went into television. I think he was doing bits and pieces in television, but he should have been doing magnificent stuff. But just anyway, Derek Royle was my man. He was wonderful, I thought.
What do you think the secret to a great comic actor or actresses?
Being able to make audience laugh. Because if they don't laugh, you've come to a grinding halt, you know, particularly if the play is a funny play.
Of all the giants, and you have worked with almost, you know, every giant, who do you just admire the most? I mean, I know it's a really difficult question.
No, it's not. There are two. Uh-huh. There are two. Laurence Olivier, without a shadow of a doubt, mesmerised an audience in Titus Andronicus. Titus, that's not a particularly good play, but it's got some wonderful speeches in it. And Larrick used to come on and reduce an audience. He was absolutely fantastic. He would mesmerise them. He was a shattering stage performer, which can't be appreciated on the screen because it's a very, very different medium. Mm. It's a different game to play altogether. And he was absolutely staggering in Titus. And on the screen, without a shadow of doubt, Cary Grant, who could listen like nobody listened. And, of course, you were mesmerised by the way that Cary listened and what he was taking in. And there's the audience. Could they give him, rightly, close-ups and things like that? And you'd see his face taking in whatever it was. And he could almost tell you what was about to happen. It was magical. I was playing pool one night at a place called the Daisy in Los Angeles, and I'd been asked to play by this is awful, terrifying name dropping, by Paul Newman, and I didn't know him from Adam. And he said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm here filming. I'm doing a movie here." And he said, "Who with?" And I said, "And he said, that's it. He's the best. He's the best we've ever had. He's the cleverest screen actor of the lot." He said. And this coming from, you know, Paul Newman, who was no slouch himself.
No.
But I think, to be honest with you, we have to be generous about each other. I think people who knock other actors all the time are stupid, because I think there's something, It requires a great deal of concentration and skill and nerve to do it in front of X hundred people or in a camera that's making your life either marvellous or a misery, or but it's going to catch every tiny little moment.
I agree. I think nerve, and I think it's what really struck me about the, just going back to The Great Escaper for a minute, was the courage as you get older. I mean, for Glenda Jackson, just to have all those close-ups of her, you know, face, which she hasn't clearly not done what a lot of actresses do, and yanked it up and stretched it and had lots of plastic. So incredibly brave just to be absolutely as she was. And she was magnificent. But
she's
the nerve,
wonderful. I think she's wonderful in it, without any question.
Wonderful,
and both she and Michael are both marvellous in it. And I think you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It was jealous. But I think what option did she have other than to turn it down?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? If you're offered it, you do it, and you can only look like how you look at 86. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Once you are 86, once you're, you know, old as a kind of a terrible old bag like I am now, I mean, you just.
But you're carrying on. I mean, you've done so much television. You've done The Crown and all sorts of things that which have made you such a well-known face.
Well, I don't really know. I don't know. I don't. But yeah, possibly. But yes.
You prefer the stage every time.
Oh, would I? I don't prefer. It's just very, very different. I like doing both, The stage engages you for a much longer time if you're in any form of success, because it means there you do eight times a week and you're on your knees on a Saturday night when you've got to do it twice, you know, at 5 and 8:30.
Yes.
And if you're playing one of the leads in it or a leading part of any sort in it, really, it requires enormous concentration and energy.
Yeah.
And filming is a very, very, very different kettle of fish. And is in many ways easier and in other ways harder. I mean, they're very different. They're very, very different. It's a different... One of them is you're doing everything outwards in order to push it at an audience in some way without appearing to do it at all, without appearing to push it. And the other one is really thinking deeply, going the other direction, so people look into you as to what you're doing, and if you're fortunate enough to get close-ups, you can really see. You know, I've been lucky in all directions, really.
Of all the plays you've been in, what was your happiest time, do you think, on the stage?
I don't know. It's difficult to say, but I think Arms and the Man, I really adored doing. I enjoyed doing John Osborne's play at the Royal Court. I enjoyed doing Algy and the Importance, and I enjoyed the lot, really. Maggie complained about everything. She was wonderfully funny, complaining, of course. She couldn't, oh, darling, it's so boring. And she was adorable and whatnot. But I think we do complain all the time, but that doesn't stop us absolutely loving what we do. But my daughter said to me once, said, "You don't appear to have enjoyed anything, Dada." But I said, "I've enjoyed all of them more than you could ever imagine. But I like having a thoroughly good tick." So,
well, we love moaning at the oldie.
Yeah, do you? Because you do moan, and certainly the older you get, the more, you know, winningly, you do tend to moan.
Yeah. So are you in something at the moment?
No, absolutely nothing. I'm barren, I think, probably for life. At 90, who the hell would want to hear you, see you, or anything else to do with you, really, in truth? And I'm not sure. Although, to be fair, when Sarah was going through the horrors of radiology...
This is your wife, Sarah Standing, who's got...
Yes, and she's
for
got
the third time.
She's got cancer for the third time, you know, and let's hope it's literally third time lucky, which means that's the end of it.
Yes.
But she was having... And I thought, I drove her to work, to hospital every day, and used to sit in the car and wait. And I thought, I just can't sit here like a great lemon and do nothing at all and listen unrelentingly to LBC and people being cross about whatever it is. And so I must learn something. So I thought I must give myself a real task. And I learnt Hamlet's longest speech, which I can now do.
What is his longest speech? I've never thought about which is his longest.
Over to Rogan, peasant, slave am I, by a long way.
Have you ever played Hamlet?
No, and I wouldn't be right for it because I'm a kind of comic clown, and I don't. When I say that, I don't. Well, I don't really know. No, I haven't. Is the truth of the matter. And Ian McKellen says you can do it at any age, and he has certainly done it apparently magnificently, at knocking 80. We once shared a cottage together, which seems deeply unlikely, but I adored it. And we were playing rogues in a really bad television in America. With a frightfully glamorous leading lady who'd been one of Charlie's Angels. I can't remember her name. But
Farrah Fawcett made her, no?
No, it wasn't from the other. It was the brown-haired one who was adorable, really sweet.
She was eclipsed by all that blonde hair of Farrah Fawcett made.
She was, wasn't she? Completely. Yes. She just waved her head once and that was it.
No. So going back to... learning lines. So your memory muscle is absolutely unbelievably intact. You don't drink, do you, John?
I do. Of course I do. I don't drink much is the answer. I don't fall down drunk all the time. But yes, I do like a glass of red wine. I do like it from time to time. I also, not against, sliding some whiskey down and all of that, but not. I don't drink a lot is the answer. So I might go a whole month and not drink anything, and then I've taken up something called beer, which I didn't drink as a young man at all. And I love drinking lager now, which I drink occasionally. If anybody else is drinking, I'll join them with a glass of lager. So, yes is the answer, but not much. Not much.
But you say you're barren and not doing anything, but excuse me, I am sitting in your wonderful room in your house, absolutely surrounded by your magnificent paintings, some of which I've seen before, but there's lots of glorious new work here. And you've never stopped painting, have you?
Well, recently I've been fairly lazy, but I do enjoy it. I mean, but I miss the fact that I actually missed the last 2 years of art school, and I wouldn't half mind it to have gone to a drama school, which my mother insisted that I didn't do. She said, no, you know quite enough now, you can go on and do it. And of course I went on, and the first time I did it, the first time I spoke, having carried a spear, and when I was carrying a spear in Titus,
what did you have to say?
I thought I didn't have to say anything, except I said, went to Peter Book one day and said, do you think I could shout die when I shovel a sword through somebody? I can't remember who it was, but I had to kill somebody. And he said, oh yes, by all means do, because then I realised and everybody else was shouting something, and I asked permission to shout die. So there was no effort attached to that at all. Then the first play I did was in weekly rep. So it meant you've got a week to get, and I'd not been to a drama school, and I couldn't understand why people were so fussed and nervous about going on, until the first time I went on, I was playing a guards officer in a play called The Reluctant Deb, and I used to have to come on with full dress uniform and a bearskin and the whole bloody lot, and carry or three plates. And indeed, in those days, because it was a weekly rep, that nobody had any money, so it was little bits of sardine on toast. And I walked onto the stage, and in blind terror, I'm thinking, I've got to say my first line now, thinking, what the hell's this? I dropped the lot. And I thought, Jesus Christ. And now there I am, and there was this guards officer, thinking, I better pick it up. So the stage was covered in shoals of fish. So there were these sardines all over the place on tiny little bits of toast, and I was on my hands and knees picking them up. And I suddenly heard the most wonderful sound, which was an audience howling with laughter, thinking it was part of the plot. And I thought, this is the most wonderful sound in the world. I then decided that I would really had to try and get into comedies, and that's when I started, and it was a very funny part, the part of the guards officer. It was written by Douglas Hume.
It's interesting that none of your children have followed you into the acting profession. You have four children, don't you, John?
I have.
one by your first wife, and three with Sarah.
And three with Sarah.
None of them have become...
They're all wonderful. We all see all of each other all the time, and they're a terrific, terrific, wonderful people, my children are, and now they are people, you know, they're not children anymore, they're all grown up, and they've all got children. India has the most enchanting grandson called Huck. Tilly's just given birth to a little girl called Romy. Archie's got a brace of children called Billy and Kit, and Alexander's got two called Tom and Will. So I've got six grandchildren from various ages, from 25 to 6 weeks. So, you know, I've got an army of people who tend to look after one and are absolutely wonderful to have around, and funny and charming and, you know, and terribly successful at being people.
You know? Well, you strike me as a very, very happy person. And I remember Sarah at one of your or her birthday parties making a wonderful speech saying you've always made each other laugh. Do you think that's a secret to a long and very happy family life?
I think because Sarah has got, you know, is witty and clever and writes frightfully well and all of that, and is, yeah, willing to laugh. And I think you have to be willing to laugh. I think it's something that people find sometimes obviously quite embarrassing or whatever it is for reason. I don't understand why people don't laugh at certain aspects of life, particularly when things are not particularly fulfilling. Then, you know, and I get furious with inanimate objects. I've thrown a bicycle away in my life. I threw a bicycle over a hedge once. Then I had to come back and pick it up. But,
oh dear.
I don't know.
John, that was absolutely wonderful. Thank you so very much. It's just been an absolute delight to talk to you.
I think it's terrible to talk about oneself all the time. It's something that I don't normally do.
But you haven't. You've been talking about all these amazing people that are household names.
Yeah.
So thank you so much.
My great pleasure. Thank you so much. You were wonderful to do it with. A joy. Absolute joy.
You've been listening to Radio Oldies, sponsored by Bailey Gifford, with me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with John Standing. You can find more podcasts like this on our website at www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. A very warm thank you again to John Standing, to our sponsor Bailey Gifford, and I very much hope you've enjoyed listening. Goodbye.